and Mission Bay was in the fine print. So it was, fortunately, at the right time, some of the development was caused by help outside the city of San Diego, along with its own bond issue. There were several bond issues passed later.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was Ed Fletcher's role at this time as a state senator?
Ed Fletcher was a senator, and he introduced the bill that transferred the tidelands and submerged lands to the legislature, and it was approved by the legislature and signed by Governor Warren. But I think probably one of the most important things that he had to do on Mission Bay was that he owned a half interest in a rock quarry in Mission Gorge, and the city owned the other half. When I went to Ed Fletcher to secure permission to use the rock, which the Army engineers had said was the best rock we can get as to density and heaviness, and that they wanted a permission to allow the contractor to use that rock, but he had to get permission of the owner. Ed told me, "What is the city requesting for its royalty on the rock?" I said, 5 cents a ton. He said, "That's all right with me." Well, he received several thousands of dollars, and as a result, he took his wife on a trip around the world with the proceeds.
Among the benefits to San Diego of this park development are navigable waters where before only small boats could sail, and only with difficulty, and an increase in shore area.
That probably is a cardinal principle of development of bay area when you consider that there was probably 11 miles or less of shoreline when we started on it and developed the islands and peninsulas. It developed over 30 miles of shoreline, which, as you say, is the important thing.
Mm-hmm. About three times.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then in addition, there are navigable waters as well.
Yes, absolutely. When Mission Bay was started as such, there were very few navigable areas where you could sail a boat that had a keel. A few power boats would get around all right, but that's all, and sometimes even that you got stranded on sandbars.
Glenn Rick, who was to a great extent behind the development of Mission Bay Park. Claire, we're going to conclude our program on Ed Fletcher with a very colorful story about an episode in his career in the state Senate, and it has to do with the Cabrillo statue, which is now at the tip of Point Loma as a part of Cabrillo National Monument. How did the statue get there?
I think that's one of my favorite stories, really. The statue had been sculpted in Portugal and was on exhibit at the New York World's Fair in 1939. It was then to be sent to San Francisco for exhibit in its World's Fair in 1939, but it didn't get there in time to be put up for the fair. So then it was stored in the garage of some Portuguese-American woman who lived in San Francisco. As Ed Fletcher tells the story in his memoirs, he is so gentlemanly that he never wants to give away her identity, and so I can't tell you what her name is. I don't know. At any rate, there it was in the garage, and it weighed 14,000 pounds, and so, of course, it wasn't exactly the kind of thing that she was too happy to have in the garage. Fletcher thought that the statue really ought to be in San Diego, and the governor of California at that time was a Democrat, Culbert Olson, and Fletcher was a Republican, and so they had political differences. They also had a difference in that Fletcher wanted the statue here in San Diego, and Olson, according to Fletcher memoirs, was going to send it to the city of Oakland. Fletcher regarded this as Olson's way of trying to obtain the votes of the Portuguese-Americans who lived in Oakland, and he thought that after all, since this was the first place that Cabrillo had landed, that the statue really ought to be here.
Well, with the governor's opposition, Fletcher was not able to pass legislation through both houses to move the statue to San Diego, but he was able to convince the Senate to pass such a resolution unanimously. Well, then he got the Secretary of State to put the great seal of the state of California on this document and on a letter he had received from the State Park Commission. And then he took these two very impressive official-looking documents and brought them to the woman at whose house the statue was being kept and showed them to her.
She was still a little bit reluctant, but Fletcher was very persuasive, and he already had a big truck there and a crane or whatever you would need to, you know, get something that weighs 7 tons onto the truck. And while they were actually loading the statue onto the truck, the telephone rang. Somebody had, you know, leaked the story, apparently. The telephone rang, as he describes it in his memoirs, and there was a phone call from somebody in Oakland threatening a lawsuit, and the lady was in tears, but Fletcher, with his great persuasion, said everything is going to be all right. They drove off with the statue, and Fletcher, again, with this tremendous persuasiveness that he had, called up a friend of his who happened to be the president of the Santa Fe Railroad and arranged for the railroad station to be kept open until they got down there with a statue, got it on the train, and shipped it to San Diego.
Ed Fletcher, Jr. remembers this episode, although, like many others, he was kept somewhat in the dark about it.
First, I knew about it I got a phone call from my dad from Sacramento telling me that he was writing me a letter, sending me a memo, and that coming down on a freight car was a big box that had to be unloaded in San Diego. And up to that time, I didn't know what it was all about. And evidently, he said, get a hold of Roscoe Hazard, he'll know what to do. And so I got a hold of Roscoe Hazard, and then far as that was concerned, what developed later was in the papers, and I learned about it more from the papers than firsthand from my dad later on.
When it got to San Diego, it was sent to the Naval Training Center, and it was absolutely under guard for quite a period of time because Governor Olson was furious, and he attacked Fletcher verbally in the newspapers. There were articles saying, you know, Fletcher accused of stealing statue, and Olson got his friends in the legislature to introduce bills, you know, to try to get the statue back, and Fletcher took the high ground and said, well, possession is nine points of the law. He also got a letter-writing campaign going, including a campaign from school children and a lot of other people saying, oh, this is where it ought to be after all Cabrillo, you know, first landed here in San Diego. And so finally, Olson gave up. And the statue then was on the Naval Training Center and was dedicated there in 1940. And then in 1942, which was the 400th anniversary of Cabrillo's landing, the statue was then moved to its present location out at the Cabrillo Monument, and it's still there.
Well, one thing I never understood is how did it get to stay there? Because this was a semi-legal venture, let's say, wasn't it?
I think the legalities were clouded, and I think that Fletcher's persistence and the fact that it was here simply wore down Governor Olson. There was a legal question also, since the government of Portugal had given the statue to the state of California. The governor contended that as the governor, you see, as the chief executive officer, he had the right to decide where it would go. But Fletcher had gotten a legal opinion saying that if it was given to the state, then the legislature, you see, representing the people of the state, should have the right to decide where it would go. And he had gotten a unanimous resolution through the Senate of the state of California.
There is a postscript to the story. As we've heard it told, there were quite a few people who didn't know quite what was coming off, and among them, for many years, was the artist who created the statue in the first place. Ron Silveira, bibliographer at the UCSD Library, later visited the sculptor in Portugal.
When I was in Portugal, after a year in Brazil, I met the sculptor of the famous statue. I looked him up, and this Senhor de Bré, And I was telling him what a fabulous statue I thought it was and how I had seen it when I was a young fella, a sailor on Point Loma. And he says, ah, that's where it is. He didn't know where it was. He only knew that it went to San Francisco. He didn't know that it ended up in San Diego.
Claire, as we come to the end of this program, I have to observe, as you were saying the other day, that it's incredible to look at the huge number of enterprises that Fletcher was involved with, and it's hard to imagine how he did it all. On top of that, of course, we have to remember that on this program we've talked about only a fraction of all of the activities that he was involved with. I think that this incredible range of activity demonstrated by men like Fletcher points out a very basic difference between Fletcher's time and our own. And Russell Crane, I think, has some interesting thoughts on those differences, which also shed a light on the motivations of men like Ed Fletcher.
Well, I think pace is a lot faster today, and people are doing so much more. They don't have the time. They're watching television and a lot of things on their time, their boats and their hobbies and so forth. But the businessmen of that era had more time on their hands, and they were really trying to better themselves along with, and they realized that they... If the city prospered, they would prosper. And so they were trying to better the city. And they had real problems because very few people will look out of their windows today and see all the trees and shrubbery out there and don't realize that we live in a semi-arid area. And without the water that we have here, we would just dry up and blow away, really, because we have very little rain. We have as... Our rain is equivalent to what they have in Arizona and some of these other places, and we've made it what it is. And there's the pioneers like Colonel Fletcher and Spreckles and Heilburn and these people that really made this area, and were unselfish in their work.
I think this certainly is one of the ways of looking at Ed Fletcher as one of the 12 who shaped San Diego. He's a combination, as of course so many of them were, a combination of unselfish, civic-minded, visionary, you know, really devoted to the good of the city as a whole and the county as a whole, in Fletcher's case. And on the other hand, you know, shrewd businessman. George Marston called him the Prince of Promoters. He knew a good thing when he saw it. He knew how to make a good deal. And he was an investor who certainly made money out of these projects himself. He had, as we've mentioned earlier, this tremendous amount of energy, and along with it went this enthusiasm, this optimism, this belief, not only in his own projects, but certainly in the future of this city. Fletcher, this land and water developer, came here to San Diego as a virtually penniless youth in around 1889, and became a millionaire, a huge property owner. This is a sort of Horatio Alger story, you know, of how you can rise from rags to riches if you work hard and keep your eye on the ball and you know what you're looking for. And I think his experiences in that very early time of riding through the backcountry, either on his bicycle or horse and buggy, when he saw the sources of the water and realized that water was crucial to the development of the area, and he also was a shrewd enough businessman to reason that whoever owned the watershed was going to someday be a wealthy man. So over a period of years, he acquired control of most of the watershed land that bordered these various rivers, San Luis Rey, San Dieguito, San Diego. In an epic legal battle that lasted throughout the 1920s, the city of San Diego, as we heard, finally achieved a court determination that awarded the city the paramount right to the water of the San Diego River, although the other companies still exercise their right to a certain amount of the water that comes from the river. Fletcher, of course, still owned the land, you see, that bordered on those areas, and was able to make a fortune in selling off, subdividing and selling off that land. I made I made a list, and I'm sure it isn't even complete, but I've made a list of some of the major things that Ed Fletcher was involved in developing, all within a period of about 25 years, that is, from about 1905 until roughly 1930. And then, of course, you know, the Depression put an end to most kinds of development. He either developed himself or was very active in the development of, you know, using other people, investors, and so on and so forth, the following communities: Pine Hills, Warner Hot Springs, Del Mar, Solana Beach, Rancho Santa Fe, Grossmont, Mount Helix, and, of course, Fletcher Hills. And I must say that one of the things that impressed me, too, about driving through many of those areas is that Fletcher knew how to plan roads well, so that you don't just have this repetitive, unimaginative grid pattern that characterized so many other early subdivisions. It's, you know, what Alonzo Horton used for downtown San Diego, for example. Fletcher, whether he figured this out on his own or whether it was as a result of the contact that he had with John Nolan, the urban planner, because Nolan and Marston and Fletcher often went into the backcountry together, and perhaps it was through that association that Fletcher, you know, acquired this kind of interest in laying out attractive contour roads so that the topography would be respected, and it makes the subdivisions, of course, much more interesting. It's also remarkable, I think, that his political career didn't really begin until he was 62 years old, and rather surprising that here he was, a Republican, running during the 1930s, when this, the, you know, the era of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and the Democrats, of course, were the most popular party at that time, and yet Fletcher was able to win election four different times, and in one of those campaigns, he was elected in the primaries, winning the primary election of not only the Republican and Democratic parties, but the Prohibition and the Socialist parties as well. For the next 12 years, he served in the California Senate, and his most noteworthy contributions there, I think, were, of course, the legislation in connection with water and his development, his legislation that made it possible for San Diego to develop Mission Bay. One other thing that he did, which is not well known, is that he established the first race relations commission in the first state race relations commission in the United States while he was serving in the California Senate. And he worked with Dennis Allen, who was a black postman in San Diego. Dennis Allen had founded the Race Relations Society in San Diego in the 1920s and constantly worked to try to make it easier for blacks to get jobs in San Diego. And Fletcher worked with Dennis Allen during the early 1940s to help open up jobs for blacks at Convair, because the management at Convair had made it very clear that they were really not interested in hiring blacks. So it took a big effort in order to bring this about. And this is, as I say, one of the lesser known things that Fletcher was involved with, but I think it tells us something about the total kind of involvement that he had with so many different projects.
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for this series of programs on local history. Our next program is the last biography of the 12. It's the story of a man whose accomplishments can be appreciated by every San Diegan. George Marston was a successful businessman with a keen interest in the community. The physical splendor of this city, our landscaped parks, the Serra Museum atop Presidio Hill, the efforts of planning the city that have allowed it to retain so much of its natural beauty. These are, in large part, the legacy of George Marston. His life is the subject of the next program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, with a repeat broadcast Wednesday evenings at 8 o'clock. A resource packet is available with the programs. Send $2 to KPBS-FM, San Diego, California, 92182. and ask for the History Resource Packet. We'd also like to hear any comments you might have about this series. That address again is KPBS-FM, San Diego, California, 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you.